Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Young, it's Here and Now. Harriet Myers, the president's newly announced pick to fill a second Supreme Court seat, is making courtesy calls to senators on Capitol Hill today. She's been the president's lawyer and White House staff secretary and the first female partner with a prominent Texas law firm, but she has never been a judge. So early response has been mostly, who is Harriet Myers? Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, who Myers will replace if confirmed, was a critical swing vote on the court, but the absence of any paper trail of judicial rulings is making it difficult for anyone to figure out Myers' legal philosophy or to imagine how she might rule on such ideologically charged issues as abortion. Earlier today, Senator Charles Schumer, Democrat from New York, said much more information is needed about Myers' record, but in his announcement this morning, President Bush called on the Senate to confirm Myers as promptly as it did Chief Justice John Roberts, who took over as the court's new leader today.
In its consideration of Chief Justice Roberts' nomination, the Senate made it clear that a well-qualified nominee committed to strictly interpret the law can be confirmed promptly and by a large bipartisan majority. As the new Chief Justice said at his swearing-in last week, the Senate vote affirmed the bedrock principle that judging is different from politics.
And standing by the president's side, Harriet Myers said she would be true to the Founding Fathers' vision of the proper role of the courts in society.
If confirmed, I recognize that I will have a tremendous responsibility to keep our judicial system strong and to help ensure that the courts meet their obligations to strictly apply the laws and the Constitution.
Well, Jonathan Turley, professor of law at George Washington University, joins us once again. Jonathan, welcome back.
It's a pleasure.
And we're also joined by John Counsel. He's senior reporter for the Texas Law Magazine, which is based in Dallas, Texas. John, thanks to you as well.
Thanks for having me.
And Jonathan Turley, I just want to start with you because last Thursday we spoke of the possibility of a Myers nomination, and you said at the time that Bush tends to go back home when he's faced with these choices. He certainly has.
He sure did. Although I have to tell you, I think this is certainly consistent with the president's inclination to stick with people he knows and feels comfortable with. But I am baffled by the choice. I mean, he was really looking at a historic moment. He could have appointed with John Roberts the equivalent of a conservative Brandeis and Holmes. You know, he could have forged not just a conservative majority, but one that would blaze new trails, you know, come up with some pretty impressive inroads into legal principle. And he didn't do that. I mean, he treated the nomination like it was a personal privilege rather than a historical moment. I mean, I don't want to be too harsh on Harriet Myers. I mean, she seems like a perfectly good person and a good lawyer. But nobody that I've talked to on the conservative or liberal sides will privately say that she was the best choice.
We're going to get some of those comments from both sides in a second, but John Counsel there in Dallas, first of all, we understand you thought it also might be a Texas friend, but not this one.
Yeah, absolutely. I thought it was going to be Al Gonzalez because he's as close to the president as Harriet is, or maybe even closer. And even before he was elected president, I had lawyers in Texas speculating that Al would be maybe even his first pick for the Supreme Court, if not his second. So this was a bit of a surprise to me as well.
But I understand you've been on the phone today with a number of Texas lawyers. So what's been their reaction?
Overwhelmingly positive. I was actually kind of surprised because she has so little judicial experience, actually none. But everyone that I've talked to has said that if there's one thing you're going to say about Harriet Myers, that she's a consensus builder, that she listens to all sides of an argument. And on that same note, lawyers that I've talked to also think that she's the perfect replacement for O'Connor because she'll fit into the middle of the court.
And how so? I mean, what do they base that on, John Counsel?
Well, they base it on the fact that if she, you know, she's been involved in government most of her career, and she's not one to stake out some position and then just hold firm to it. She listens to, you know, I mean, she can take people who are radically on opposite sides of an issue and find some common ground and get everybody to vote with her.
Well, Jonathan Turley, your thoughts, because that's sounding a lot like Sandra Day O'Connor.
Well, it does sound a bit like O'Connor, although I have to tell you, I don't like this model. I mean, on a personal basis, I think there's a problem when you can go through 30 years as a lawyer and not say anything substantively on the important issues of your time. I was critical of John Roberts for that, you know, he spoke a lot as an attorney representing other parties. But, you know, the irony is that people like Bob Bork, who thought deeply about issues and took a stand, and got involved and contributed, they were barred. But people like Harriet Myers and John Roberts, who didn't take those risks, did not contribute for decades in a public way to this debate, will tend to sail through. And, you know, I find that troubling. But the thing I find most troubling is, you know, Harriet Myers does not belong on the Supreme Court. I hate to be perfect.
That's pretty blunt.
Yeah, it's a very blunt. I mean, if the Supreme Court ideally should be for people who are outstanding contributions to the court. And the president walked by leading lights in the conservative movement, really people who have pushed the envelope, who people like Michael Luttig, Harvey Wilkinson, Michael McConnell. These are the people that were really the intellectual leaders. And quite frankly, whether you agree with them or not, those are the types of people that belong on the court.
Well, in fact, let's get some feedback. Both Jonathan and John, hold on there a second, because the reaction has been coming in. For instance, Manuel Miranda, chair of the Conservative Third Branch Conference, agrees with you, Jonathan. He says this is the most unqualified choice since Abe Fortas, who had been the president's lawyer. The nomination of a nominee with no judicial record is a significant failure for the advisors that the White House gathered around. On the other hand, Leonard Leo, who is the executive vice president of the Federalist Society, is quoted as saying she has been a forceful advocate of conservative legal principles and judicial restraint throughout her career. And we also spoke earlier today with Elliot Mintzberg. He's counsel for the liberal People for the American Way. Now, his concern is about Harriet Myers' close relationship with the president.
We need someone on the Supreme Court who is truly committed to basic fundamental rights and liberties and who can truly be independent of the other two branches, including the executive branch, particularly in light of all of the grabs for power, to be frank, we've seen from this White House. Harriet Myers do that? That's the question.
What kind of questions do you think should be asked of her?
Well, I think a lot of them. I think it's important, first of all, to find out her views on some of these basic fundamental issues, the authority of Congress to pass laws protecting Americans, basic civil rights and civil liberties views. I think we also need to find out a little bit more about how closely associated she's been with so many of the White House's positions on so many of these issues. Will she recuse herself from all of these issues, not decide them, or will she, despite her close association with the president, suggest that she can fairly and independently decide issues that go directly to those kinds of serious questions? Those are a few of the questions that I think she needs to be asked.
Isn't it likely that any presidential appointee is going to have some kind of closeness with the president?
Absolutely. But if you look at people that have been in that category and been nominated to the Supreme Court before, there are also people who have had independent careers and accomplishments. Earl Warren, a close confidant of President Eisenhower, served several terms as governor of California. Abe Fortas, whose nomination, by the way, was stopped in part because of concerns about how close he was to the president, nonetheless was independently one of the best reputed lawyers in the country, had argued the landmark case of Gideon versus Wainwright. The list goes on and on. So when you're dealing with somebody who has been so closely associated with the president throughout so much of her career, I think it brings those questions a little bit more to the fore.
Your thoughts about some of the other response that's coming in. I'm looking at a quote from Eugene Delgado, who's president of the conservative group Public Advocate, and he says the president's nomination of Myers is a betrayal of the conservative pro-family voters whose support put Bush in the White House in both the 2000-2004 elections. When there are so many proven judges in the mix, it's unacceptable this president has appointed political crony with no conservative credentials. Your response to that?
Well, I think there's no question that there is concern from the right, because the president clearly has not chosen someone with obvious conservative right-wing credentials in the neighborhood of a Scalia or a Thomas. He's, I think, to be honest, trying to avoid an ideological confrontation. The question, though, is whether he's created other difficulties in choosing someone who is so closely associated with him.
That's Elliot Mintzberg of People for the American Way. So we're back with John Counsel, senior reporter for Texas Lawyer Magazine, and Jonathan Turley, law professor at George Washington University. And John Counsel, it seems the thing that you have noted, that this is a close friend of the president's, might be a stumbling block in the hearings.
Actually, I think it's going to work to her advantage, because she doesn't have anything on paper that you can assail. And I think that maybe that was a part of the calculation from the White House, is that, you know, some of the judges that they were looking at that were named as potential nominees all had pretty big black marks against them. Two of them would have been Priscilla Owen and Edith Jones, who are both on the Fifth Court of Appeals, or the Fifth Circuit in New Orleans. But if you really go back into the president's history of appointing judges to high courts, when he was governor, he would take people who may not be traditional nominees. I mean, it would be people that he trusted, people that he met with and sat down and just talked with. Mm-hmm. They weren't necessarily just people that came; they were advocated by his advisors. He picked a woman named Deborah Hankinson, who had represented school districts. In that time, there continues to be a big fight on public school financing. He liked how her position on issues. He put her on an appellate court, and then he nominated her to the Texas Supreme Court, and she was a fine judge.
One second there, Jonathan Turley. In the minute that we have, I guess you know what it's sounding like, though, is that people on the right as well as the left are going to be pressing for answers to questions in these hearings.
Well, they will, but I don't think it'll be successful. I think the Democrats have already lost this fight before it began. I mean, after all, how can people like Senator Leahy and others demand that she answer questions when they just allowed Roberts to be confirmed and voted for him when he refused to answer the questions? And on top of that, we've heard this morning that a couple of Democrats, including apparently Minority Leader Reid, actually suggested Harriet Myers. So, you know, the bizarre quality to these nominations is just the total lack of coherence to the Democratic position. I don't see how they can filibuster Myers for not answering questions when just a couple of weeks ago most of them voted for John Roberts, who refused to do the very same thing.
And by the way, we've had listeners respond to your saying that one other time. You mean he hasn't given definitively his thoughts on issues like abortion, and that's what you mean by not answering questions.
Yeah, I mean, John Roberts said that legal ethics prevented him from answering questions on things like privacy. That's not actually true, but the Democrats did not challenge it. They accepted it, and many of them voted for him.
So sort of setting the template for the next hearings, which are going to be coming up when?
Well, they hope to have apparently they want to get her on the court by Thanksgiving. Usually we've got a couple of weeks of vetting and the ABA report, but we could see a fast turnaround here. Frankly, there's not much to look at, so I'm not too sure what we'd be spending our time with.
No, the resume is about a paragraph long, but we'll see. We've been speaking with Professor Jonathan Turley of George Washington University Law School, also joined by John Counsel, senior reporter for Texas Lawyer Magazine based in Dallas, to give us the Dallas, Texas perspective. Thanks to both for you, both of you. Looks like interesting times ahead.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And stay with us. Much more coming up here and now. Here and now. U.S. troops are conducting an offensive called Operation Iron Fist near the border with Syria. The U.S. military says the group, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, has turned the region into a staging post for foreign fighters coming into Iraq from Syria. The offensive comes 2 weeks before a national referendum on Iraq's new constitution, and as insurgents throughout Baghdad have killed at least 200 people in the past 8 days, including 16 U.S. troops. Last week, Iraq was the topic of discussion at the Brattle Theater here in Cambridge, Massachusetts. The panelists, all of whom have spent time in Iraq recently, included a journalist, a soldier, and an artist. Well, today we thought we'd let you listen in on their discussion. First up, the panel addressed whether U.S. forces understand the workings of Iraqi society. Now, you'll hear from Army Sergeant and author Kayla Williams, you've heard here on Here and Now. Also, Steve Mumford, an artist who was with the U.S. military in Iraq over a period of a year. But the first speaker is Anthony Shadid of The Washington Post.
It strikes me in Baghdad and Iraq in general, there is an amazing ability to sense an outsider, to sense a stranger. I mean, it was the way you survived under Saddam in a way. It's the gait, what you wear, you know, even your gestures. I mean, it's very easy to identify somebody that's not from the area, and I think Iraqis have a knack for that. I mean, I never traveled in the country without an Iraqi colleague.
And that was one of the things that the U.S. Soldiers never got, was that sense of who belonged somewhere and who didn't, what the locals looked like and who might have been a foreigner, and what different groups people belonged to. I asked repeatedly what different colored turbans meant while I was there, and no one could tell me, and your book explained so much of it, and that was, I mean, that's a very telling statement, that I was in intelligence and nobody was able to explain that sort of thing to me.
Right. But, you know, one thing I would say, I spent, I would say, maybe two-thirds of my time with military units in Baghdad and in the Sunni Triangle. And it struck me that it varied a lot from unit to unit and from officer to officer. And, you know, some kind of had a knack, you know, for relating to people, and they were smart enough to figure out subtleties in the way the local society worked. And I saw relationships formed that I thought were successful relationships with mayors, with people on the NACs and the DACs, and neighborhood advisory councils and district advisory councils. So in some cases, I felt that there were successful relationships. The problem that often struck me is the unit would be there for a year, and then they'd have maybe a month to introduce the next unit to the same area of operations.
Right, that's a disastrous part of it. And while I was there, we moved constantly. There was no chance to establish close relationships, at least for my personal team. And then at the beginning, we were just getting established in a neighborhood in Baghdad, and then we got moved and then moved again. And so that sense of trying to start to establish trust and relationships and knowing that we were about to be moved somewhere else and knowing how important those personal relationships are, and then knowing that we were going to be yanked away and not knowing what type of unit would replace us and if they would be the kick-down-doors type or the let's form a relationship type. It is very frustrating.
That last voice you might recognize is Kayla Williams, a former sergeant in a military intelligence unit of the Army and recent guest on Here and Now. The panel was also asked to respond to a question about how ordinary Iraqis respond to the presence of U.S. troops in their communities. Reporter Anthony Shadid and artist Steve Mumford handled this one. You'll hear first from Mumford.
The nature of an occupation is us and them. You know, there's probably no way around that. But I think that there's subtleties to it. One thing that a lot of my Iraqi male friends explained to me was how much Iraqis love the army, which is going to sound a little strange. It's not that they loved being in Saddam's army. But and perhaps this is a generalization that they were making about undereducated people that didn't have other prospects. But whatever it was, the generalization that they often made to me was that Iraqis love the army, they like uniforms, they like guns. There's something about the martial spirit of the army that a lot of people in the country enjoy, which I think you have to sort of separate that concept from the politics of Saddam. Now, and that's also a generalization and a cliche, but I felt that there was some truth to that. For example, when you go in the marketplace and look at children's toys, toys for boys are almost universally mini AK-47s. I mean, it is a country that loves martial stuff. Every U.S. base is surrounded by little Iraqi boys who are sort of adoring of all this American hardware, you know, the M-16s, the Abrams tanks, all this stuff. So it's complicated. There's both a terrible hurt pride about having this occupier rumbling down your streets in an Abrams tank. There's also a fascination with the power, the awesome power of the military hardware. There's a lot of things sort of thrown in there. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I don't think it's just a simple equation of the oppressor.
Anthony? You know, it's interesting because I saw the same thing. But I saw it rather than something separate from Saddam. I saw it as in a way a consequence of Saddam. I thought there is a, you know, Iraq. I think people who have spent time in the Arab world know that Iraq has a reputation for a certain harshness, a certain toughness. Among other Arabs, but I think there was a militarization. I mean, when people ask me why is Iraq the way it is today. I would always point almost directly back to the war with Iran in the 1980s, when you had a million dead and wounded on both sides, one in four men, I think, maybe even more, under arms. There was a certain, you know, kind of a culture of violence, a logic of the gun that was introduced, and I think that held sway in Iraq during those times. And I think this militarization of the culture, a certain brutalization as well, has very much carried over today, and I think defines a lot of how politics operate. I think there is a certain fascination with the military, and almost, you know, it's hard to meet a man maybe 10 years older than me, 5 years older than me, who didn't serve, who doesn't often have a bullet wound, and they'll show you those wounds.
They all want to show you their scars.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's pretty remarkable. I think to me it was the equivalent of World War I to Europe.
That's Anthony Shadid of The Washington Post. We also heard from artist Steve Mumford and veteran and author Kayla Williams. Moderating the panel at the Brattle Theater in Cambridge, Massachusetts, was reporter and author Michael Goldfarb. His new book tells the story of his time in Iraq. It's called Ahmed's War, Ahmed's Peace. For more on all of the authors, go to our website, here-now.org. And while you're at the website, send us a note. We always welcome your thoughts on the program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave a message at 617-358-0397. 617-358-0397. Please remember to tell us how to pronounce your full name and tell us the town you're from. Tomorrow on Here and Now, more controversy in the Catholic Church in Boston involving a priest removed from his parish by the Archdiocese. Was he targeted for political reasons? That's tomorrow. Stay with us. Much more ahead, Here and Now. Funding for Here and Now. It's Here and Now. Another sign that things are slowly getting back to normal in New Orleans. School is now open for some students for the first time since Hurricane Katrina. But as residents return, they're faced with what's being called the nation's worst ever environmental disaster, a toxic brew of raw sewage, sediment, and millions of gallons of spilled oil. The only way to really see it is from the air. And Boston Globe environmental reporter Beth Daly did just that. She joins us in the studio with more. Beth, what did you see on your air survey?
It was sort of stunning because when you fly, you really do take in the entire scope of the damage. And what you see are marshlands flattened brown and salt water intrusion from the storm surge. You see enormous holding oil tanks crumpled like soda cans, oozing black oil or goo. One neighborhood was completely covered in oil.
You talked to scientists who said the damage was unparalleled in scope and variety. And today the EPA is going to begin to take soil and sediment samples. What will they find?
So they're probably going to take sediment samples in New Orleans right now. And one of the big concerns after Katrina was not only what was in this sort of toxic brew that everyone called, you know, the sludge of oil and perhaps some industrial chemicals. There are a lot of things called orphan barrels floating around New Orleans right now, which are industrial barrels that simply floated out of warehouses. Their labels are peeled off from the water, and they're leaking. And so they really want to find out what's in the sediment. But almost more importantly, as the weather dries, they're very concerned that this sort of toxic muck will start releasing particles into the air that could make people sick. And I think they're very concerned about what's first in that muck and then what people who are returning to the city might be breathing in.
Oh, boy. Well, let's go back to the oil. We haven't seen, you know, the kinds of pictures we saw from the Exxon Valdez disaster, for instance, animals covered in oil. So tell us, what has been the damage so far?
No, it's very hard. It's actually very, very hard to really comprehend the damage, because a lot of environmental damage, it's going to be basically oozing out, much like the oil in the weeks and months to come. There are about 100 animals that have been found with oil. Some have survived. Some are endangered, like the brown pelican. Most are rails, these sort of marsh birds. The thing is about a lot of birds is that they flew away when the hurricanes came in. And so now they're just returning to the area. So now that if oil's still there, they're going to start getting it on them. It's very hard to comprehend how much oil is in those marshes, and it's not always apparent from the air. What the Department of Environmental Quality in Louisiana and the Coast Guard are trying to do is contain all this oil so they can sort of scoop it up. But it's quite clear that it's leaking everywhere.
And that's the difference between this and another like major oil spill, is that it's gone down all these little roots.
Exactly. I mean, Exxon Valdez, you basically had a it's a horrible disaster, but you also had a lucky problem. It was came from one source, right? And it all gathered in Prince William Sound. It was a horrible disaster, but you knew where it was and you could scoop it up. Here, it spread over miles and miles, hundreds of miles of area.
Scientists tell us that the environment is pretty resilient in some ways, and that a lot of this toxic waste will biodegrade. But I know that there's been so much other harm done by the sediments, for instance, on the oyster beds. Tell us about that.
Yeah, what happened is that the storm brought in it didn't only release the toxic stuff that was in the cities and the holding tanks of the oil, but it released a very large environmental natural disaster. What it did is bring in lots and lots of salt water. Salt water kills the fresh marshlands. It kills the rice fields that also serve as crawfish farms in a different season. It also brought in vast amounts of sediment that simply smothered all the oyster beds completely. It's a delicate balance down there because the economy is so incredibly dependent on that ecosystem that if it takes 3 years to recover, will the farmer be out of business who raises rice and crawfish farms? Will the sugarcane farmer be able to make a living?
So nature may recover, but the economy may not.
Exactly.
Well, we're going to be speaking in a moment with a representative of DuPont, which has a chemical plant on the coast of Mississippi, further north than where you were. Mississippi environmental officials say there's been no evidence of a spill from that plant. But residents along the coast are wondering about both chemical plants and these inland oil refineries that have on-land waste pools. And these residents are saying, how could a 20- or 30-foot surge not wash the waste out of these pools or the oil out of these pools?
I didn't see any evidence of these waste pits when I flew over the area. Unfortunately, the problem is that we're looking at this now. It's 4 weeks after the fact. It's unclear to really get a complete impression of exactly what happened when you're looking at something with such a time delay. So we just don't know.
Beth Daly, environmental reporter for the Boston Globe. Beth, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Well, what about chemical plants? Last week, we spoke to Sierra Club volunteer Becky Gillette, who expressed concern about the DuPont plant in DeLisle, Mississippi, where they make titanium dioxide pigments used in paint. And joining us on the line, DuPont's plant manager in DeLisle, Pat Nichols. Pat, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And Becky sent us aerial photos of the plant that were taken just before the storm. And we can see these waste pools that stored the waste product from your plant. And as you well know, your plant makes dioxins, which, you know, considered a dangerous chemical if not treated properly.
Yes.
There is concern that the wind from the storm might have blown these waters out of the pools. What do you do to protect against that?
Well, thank you. There are a number of measures that we took very proactively all in the design of the plant to begin with. Most people don't recognize that we have a 20-foot levee around our plant site. And then as you progressively go up, which you couldn't see from the pictures that you took, that our solid waste units are some 45 to 50 feet above sea level. So they're at the highest point on our plant site.
And what about the winds? Because many residents have had mentioned that the winds would have blown some of these waters. And there are people who swear that they saw white film out on the ocean the day after the storm.
Well, you know, we have not seen anything like that. And we also, not only did we do a really good job in preparing, we had an on-site team that weathered the storm. We're the first to assess the plant just moments after the storm had passed by.
And we want to point out, again that Mississippi, that the Mississippi Department of Environmental Quality says that while the plant was inundated, some rail cars were pushed onto their sides. No hazardous material leaks were observed.
Absolutely. It was a huge storm surge for everyone. And we had, within 24 hours, visits by EPA and MDEQ and have had substance visits from both organizations, all of which have found our findings to be exact, and that is that we've not had any, you know, adverse effects or releases to the environment that should cause anyone any concerns around the health.
But, you know, Pat, as you well know, there are nearly 2,000 lawsuits pending against your plant. Recently, a jury awarded $14 million to a local oysterman with a rare form of cancer, agreeing with his claim that his cancer was caused by dioxins from your plant. I'm aware that you, DuPont, is appealing that award. But given that, coupled with these storms and the fears of some of the residents, any thought in DuPont's mind of moving further inland? Why does a company with such dangerous materials have to be right there in a hurricane zone?
Well, and of course, we have a very strong safety and environmental, you know, background and implementation here on the plant site that has allowed us for 26 years to be, you know, just a great neighbor in this area. So I think part of it is making sure that we're all grounded on the right facts. Yes, we do produce dioxin-like compounds. We produce a very small amount of them. And so we're going to continue to do the right things in being an excellent neighbor here on the coast.
Pat Nichols, DuPont's plant manager in DeLisle, Mississippi. Pat, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
And don't forget, still to come, Ravi Shankar. You're listening to Here and Now.
Rhythm of violin, drop on down, well now, I'm an old popsman, got done, work on.
He'd been called the poet of Black America, but now his voice is silent. Playwright August Wilson died yesterday of liver cancer in Seattle. His 10-play cycle included Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, Fences, and last year's Gem of the Ocean. It chronicled the African-American experience in 20th century America, winning 2 Pulitzer Prizes, a Tony, and 7 New York Drama Critics Circle Prizes along the way. Well, joining us in the studio to talk more about the legacy of August Wilson is Michael Masso. He's managing director of the Huntington Theater here in Boston. They've staged 7 of Wilson's works. And Michael, Wilson announced his illness in August, but I'm sure it must have still been a shock to you.
Oh, well, it was a shock. I mean, yesterday was a shock.
Because he seemed so indomitable, and he had this huge work of art.
He was an indomitable spirit. I mean, enormous energy, a personal force as an individual, a great storyteller, a great source of life always.
Yeah.
So the notion that he could be weakened even by liver cancer was still very difficult to take.
Do you have a personal memory of working with August Wilson, something that sticks out for you?
One of the great pleasures of my life in the theater is that every time we did a play, August would spend some time in my office and I would ask him what the next play was. And in front of me, characters would come to life.
Do you mean that he spoke every character for you as he said?
He spoke to them all. And in fact, he described, in Radio Golf, there's a character named Sterling Johnson. And as he was describing, he said, so this guy comes in to the office and he's talking. And I realize he's just, you know, he's full of crap. You know, he's talking. He's not making any sense. And he's telling a story. And suddenly I realize that's Sterling Johnson from Two Trains Running, a play set 30 years earlier. He said, I didn't know it was Sterling until he came in and started talking. That's the way August lived the life of his characters.
Let's listen to an excerpt from the most recent Huntington production, Gem of the Ocean, one of the last plays that Wilson actually wrote, but it's chronologically the first in the cycle.
Yes.
Here we have Felicia Rashad and John Earl Jelks. Felicia playing almost a mythical character, a woman who is 287 years old, sort of the guiding spirit of the cycle mentioned in several of the other plays. Let's listen.
Citizen. They call me Citizen Barber.
Was you looking for money, Mr. Citizen? I'd give you $2 if I had my purse. Well, you can go in that room there and bring me my purse, and I'll give you $2. In that room there on the nightstand, you can go get it, and I'll give you $2.
I ain't looking for no money. I ain't no robber. I come to see you.
August started with us in 1986 on Joe Turner's Come and Gone, which we did with Yale Repertory Theater with his great collaborator and mentor, Lloyd Richards. What we witnessed over the course of 20 years is an evolution of August, first as someone who was very deferential, at least in public, to Lloyd Richards, and then very shortly on in the process, finding his own voice and his own power. He never wanted to fit into any sort of hole.
Right. Once he found that voice, he used it quite a bit. As you know, he received a bit of criticism when he insisted that if a film version of the play Fences were to be made, it had to have a black director. He had that very public battle with Robert Brustein of the American Rep Theater over in Cambridge about colorblind casting. You know, Wilson saying, you know, you can't have Death of a Salesman with a black cast, it wouldn't be the same experience. And Brustein saying that that was part of, you know, a self-segregating thinking. Wilson was very opinionated, especially when it came to the blackness of his work.
Well, he created for the American theater, for our audiences, for the world, a vision of black America that had never been seen before. And the notion to him that somehow he was being pigeonholed by doing that was laughable. He called himself openly and proudly a race man, somebody who cared and felt it was his life's work to work in the vineyard of life about African Americans in this country.
I was struck by the fact in his obituaries that August Wilson left school at an early age because he was accused of plagiarizing a paper. And so he's self-educated. He spent days in the library reading. He sure showed those teachers. And just how wonderful, as tragic as the story is, how wonderful that he got to finish.
Yes. He finished a rough draft of Radio Golf, the last play he wrote, in time for a production at Yale, but it was really half a script. The last things he was doing was editing, putting final touches on his play that was produced at Los Angeles, and it's a wonderful piece.
So he got to say that last word.
He did.
A Huntington Theater Managing Director Michael Masso speaking to us about the late, great African-American playwright August Wilson, who died on Sunday from liver cancer. Michael, thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more ahead, Here and Now. It's Here and Now. American audiences first discovered Ravi Shankar in the late 1960s when Western hippies such as the Beatles, George Harrison, sought mysticism and enlightenment in Ravi Shankar's music. Harrison later dubbed him the godfather of world music, and Queen Elizabeth knighted him. Now Ravi Shankar is also known as the father of Grammy winner Nora Jones. Pandichi Ravi Shankar is now 85, but he continues to tour the world and is now leading the third Festival of India tour. He brings with him an ensemble of musicians, including his 24-year-old daughter, Anushka, who's also a talented sitar player. And Ravi Shankar joins us now. Welcome.
Hello.
Hi. Your website calls you a musical messiah. What are you spreading exactly?
I don't know. It's for others to say all that. I never think myself. I'm a musician. That's all I know.
Yeah. Well, having been in one of your audiences, they are mesmerizing. But I was tickled to read in one of your interviews that while you were embraced by the Woodstock generation back in the 60s, you were not always happy with them.
Well, that was for the reason that this young generation at that time, they came to listen to me because of George Harrison and all that. And they expected our music to be like a pop music, and they were behaving like that, you know, smoking and being very free and loud. So that was the thing that was very difficult period for me. But I had to tell them, and gradually it became all right, and then there was no problem.
What did you tell them?
Well, I had to tell them not to smoke. Please be quiet. I mean, if you go to hear a serious concert, Bach or Beethoven or Mozart, you wouldn't behave like this. And I request them to be, you know, more respectful to the music, you see.
It's obviously serious music to you. Would you say that it's spiritual music?
It is serious, and I won't say it is religious, but we have all the different aspects in our music, very serious, very serene, very spiritual, and very romantic, very playful, and really very exciting rhythmically. So it has all the material to please different sections. It's nothing that you can clap or shout along with it, you know. That's the wrong conception.
Tell us about breathing prana into your music.
That sounds very philosophical and high-handed, but all you do is just let yourself go and listen to the music and let the music express itself.
Thank you. Shankar, you estimate that your audience is made up of about 80% middle-class white people. Do you wonder why there aren't more Indians in the audience?
Yeah, I do wonder sometimes, but it depends upon different places. There in some places there are a little more, some less, according to the population. And also many of our Indians are more interested in the lighter type of music, like the Bollywood music. And
this is from the Bollywood films. And Bhangra, there are all sorts of modern mixes of traditional Indian music that are popular today. Is that moving people perhaps away from the more traditional?
No, I think the ratio can be compared same like in this country, where younger generation and average people like more of pop music, rock music, and jazz, and bluegrass, and all this country music, and less people really go to operas or traditional classical Western music, symphony, etc. Well, same thing in India. We have the same ratio.
Well, there's at least one young Indian who is very much involved in the music, and that's your daughter, Anushka Sitar Virtuoso, a beautiful young woman. What's that? Is there a difference, by the way, because she is younger, is there a difference between her playing and yours?
Well, I have given her all the training in the classical, and she's absolutely fantastic. But being young and being inventive and creative as well, she is also finding her own expression, which is very natural, which I also did, having learned from my traditional guru. So it's something which is bound to happen.
On the other hand, your other daughter, Nora Jones, has made her mark in jazz. When she was moving in that direction, were you sitting there thinking, oh, no?
No, I have never had that feeling. I am a great admirer of old jazz and country western music, all that I have appreciated. And it's very natural for Nora to be like what she is, because she was born and brought up here and, you know, influenced from her childhood with jazz and country music.
Have you played with her professionally? I mean, for the public consumption?
No, unfortunately, that never happened, because she was always into this music, that what she does.
Yeah, well, it would be something to look forward to, I would think.
Maybe someday we shall. Who knows?
Well, Ravi Shankar, who's made such a mark on music in so many different ways.
I hope you come to this concert, because it's going to be very different and broader aspect of our music, with 11 wonderful other musicians and my daughter as well. Different instruments and vocal music as well. It's going to be something very different.
Yeah. Well, we look forward to that. And I just want to ask you, Indian culture comes and goes in the U.S. and Europe, and right now it's very much in. Your thoughts on that, this love affair that comes and goes in waves?
I believe something which is really deep stays. It doesn't just fade away, because in this country, like whole world now, music and everything comes and goes, new things comes, and then everybody forgets it after, say, a few weeks or a few months, and it goes on like that. But there are certain traditional, wonderful, beautiful things in each culture that always stays and will stay, I'm sure.
Ravi Shankar, about to begin the third Festival of India tour across the U.S. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And for more on Ravi Shankar's tour, visit our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.